discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to Weekends. I, for one, am still getting over Mike Netta. Who would have thought that Mike needs a little bit more sugar after he finished his interview? But it certainly is a breath of fresh air, isn't it, when you can look at the crazy events that are going on and provide both perspective and a desperate need of a sense of humour in these very difficult, trying times. And I tell you what, the show is not going to slow down at all, because this hour we're coming back to Australia. And I'm going to introduce you or reintroduce you to one of Australia's best researchers. David Archibald is standing by. I'm going to bring him in just a moment. And for those that have heard or listened to David's work and been to his presentations, incredibly thorough. And we're going to look at what's going on between Australia and what China's really going on with. David's research, including some pictures that I should be able to put up on screen, will help explain the work that he's doing in working out what's really going on. Is China a threat? Should Australia be scared? And why are our politicians just seemingly all over the place? Let's not waste another moment. I'll introduce you to him right now. David Archibald graduated in geology from the University of Queensland. He's been a visiting fellow at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., a graduate school for the Department of Defense, State Department, U.S. intelligence agencies. He gives lectures on climate, cancer science, COVID science, and fighter aircraft design. He's an author of several books, including Solar Cycle 24, Twilight of Abundance, Why Life in the 21st Century Will Be Nasty, Brutish, and Short, The Past and Future of Climate, American Gripen, The Solution to the F-35 Nightmare. And he's also the author of The Anti-Cancer Garden in Australia. He certainly is a busy man, and we've been lucky to secure him for this hour. David Archibald, welcome back to Weekends.
Thanks, Jason.
Good to see you. Goodness me, you are the hardest working man in the business. There's not a topic that you are not somehow involved with, understanding, and it's this ability to be able to look at all these different areas and then form a big picture understanding of what's really going on. Perhaps if we could maybe do a bit of a Tarantino in this hour and start with the end first. David, that book title, that the life in the 21st century is going to be nasty, brutish, and short, it's looking that way, isn't it?
I've actually got friends who, I wrote that back in 2014, and I've got friends recently said, well, you predicted it all, it's all happening.
Isn't it shocking, though, that this is the way that it is? Do you see that there's a process, though, to this? Is it a case of being able to disseminate the correct information to provide the warning for the people that somehow will stand up and tell their governments that's it, enough is enough? Or is it this just a process of power and authority just squashing the little people, and unfortunately we have to go through this particular era in history and maybe come out the other side and then rebuild?
Actually, if I knew, Jason, the answer to that question, but let's go back a bit. What shocked me back in 2011, I was overseas at the time, and I came back, and I was told Qantas had grounded aircraft in Australia because a volcano blew up in Chile, a little volcano, and they could see a little puff of dust move across the 20,000 kilometres across the southern Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, and they were scared of that. And I thought, Qantas is supposed to be run by aircraft engineers, and they're very complicated and they're very competent, and they got scared by something. It's like being back in the Middle Ages of people believing in spirits and the rest of it. And after that, I thought, we're just going to have to go through a hell lot of pain and suffering before we come out the other side. That's my attitude.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem that you can kind of be able to provide enough information for people to smell a rat and go, okay, I get that. Now let me do my own research. It just seems that most people are distracted. And like Mike said in the last hour, people are concerned, and he has a sort of a barometer on his Twitter page by what they interact with. And people are more concerned with fuel prices than they might be concerned with the fact that their liberties will be taken away. It's a little bit of a bridge too far. And it's not to criticize people. It's just to say that how complicated life really is. And if you're lucky enough to be able to take the time to explore the perspective and be able to reflect and therefore do the research and even just do the reading of someone else's work, such as your own, then maybe you can get what's going on. But it just seems that most people just don't have those luxuries.
Well, a lot of people are busy leading their lives. They don't know what's true or what's not. Anybody could be a snake oil salesman. I don't blame them, really. Well, I blame politicians. If you speak to them, their beady eyes glaze over. They've already made up their mind. They don't want to hear anything else. But I continue to write, and I've got to explain the world to myself, for starters.
That is a really good point, isn't it? It's almost like it's a form of therapy to be able to do the research to confirm a suspicion, an intuition, some sort of gut feeling. And if that's how it works, then you're certainly doing the hard yards. Now, there's a lot that we're going to talk about today, specifically about China and its sort of movements. And you've documented brilliantly. You've provided photographs in your articles in the Wentworth Report. But before we get started, I just want to just get your perspective now on the climate change story. If you were to describe it to someone who's smelt the rat and says, yeah, I just don't buy how parts per million can make the temperature of the earth go up far enough that we're all going to drown because the polar ice caps melt. How do you describe the nonsense that the climate change narrative is to an average person who starts to go, yeah, I don't buy it either?
Well, if you want to start at the beginning, one of the first was actually a Luftwaffe meteorologist in the Second World War, who after in the 1950s said the problem is going to be carbon dioxide. It's actually been a socialist sort of notion. And then it was the fall of communism in 1991. Communism, socialism was discredited, and they needed another excuse to control the world. And then that morphed into also the COVID, the psychopaths who wanted to kill off a great chunk of the planet. They needed some moral fig leaf to justify it to themselves. And so climate came along. So climate almost died about 6 years ago, lost interest, people lost interest in it, and then it sort of booted up again. In terms of the people who are against it, I'm a geologist by background, and originally there was a geologist who about 15 to 20 years ago said, it's all nonsense, temperature of the planet goes up and down in the ice ages, you know, very rapidly, and we're living in this beautiful time between two glaciations. And then the juggernaut just kept going. There's so many people sucking on the tit of government. The Bureau of Meteorology, the CSIRO, all tell lies regarding climate and global warming. But more recently, the physicists have come along. A couple of physicists have been given Nobel Prizes and then come out and say, I think global warming is a nonsense because it can't happen. And they're simply offended by the fact that science is being produced for this cause. That's it in a short nutshell about it.
That's such an interesting point, isn't it? Because those that are watching on, and this idea the science is settled is an anti-scientific statement on its own. And you're not the only geologist, of course, that is rejecting the narrative entirely. There are many. So how is it that science can be separated between acceptance and the idea that it can't be accepted? It's always about, you know, new discovery, etc. And we sit here and we watch on. It's incredibly disturbing from the point of view, first of all, that you cannot even have a discussion or a debate when someone tells you that it's settled, it's off limits. It just feels like you're being intellectually bullied by those that aren't intellectually up to the debate in the first place.
Well, I find it quite disappointing that just about every institution in Australia has been co-opted into this, and they need something to believe in. It's actually a bit deeper in that seemingly we've evolved to believe in a religion, so to help run human society, that we have morals and ethics and the rest of it. And it's just that global warming fills that. It's like Genesis. That mankind thrashes the Garden of Eden, so God throws us out and we have to wear sackcloth and ashes. And I feel it's just, there's nothing to be into because it's their whole belief system. And they have to change their whole character if they were not to believe in global warming. They'd have to find something else. To ease them to believe in something else, we have to find something nice for them to believe in that's actually positive. And it's going to build orphanages and schools and hospitals. Global warming as a religion, to do that, it just destroys.
And then here we are. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it, that something that is completely invisible, that really no one would notice the difference between a 1 degree rise in temperatures. I mean, Bill Gates, I think it was January of last year, was in Sydney, Australia, at the Lowy Institute. And whilst all of us have been brainwashed to believe in this 1.5 degrees, if the carbon dioxide goes from 4 parts per million to 5 parts per million, and Gates's argument was, well, we're not even going to get to 1.5. Maybe we'll get to 2.5 degrees. Like, he's some sort of authority. He's the vaccine czar. He's now the climate change czar, not tertiary educated, never elected to public office. And yet here we are listening to this guy tell us how it's going to be. Is Gates at the top of the tree, David, in terms of pulling strings, or is he just one another puppet playing his role?
He's not at the absolute top, because when COVID came along, he only got into that German company a month before the outbreak occurred. Originally, they were all, including Rishi Sunak's investment company, was long Moderna from a decade ago. So Moderna had been chosen as the vehicle some time ago. Gates was long Moderna, but he didn't get into whatever that thing is that did the deal with Pfizer until a month before the outbreak occurred. So he wasn't in charge of everything. But on the other hand, he did finance most of the COVID development, also all the conferences which were telling governments how to react to it and keep them all on the same page. When India was about to introduce a lot of prophylactics against COVID and not have that, the uptake of the vaccine, Gates flew in and offered them a couple of hospitals and a university, and that's what bought them off. Gates has been very much a part of forcing COVID upon us. I wouldn't... The climate is a reasonably easy subject to get on top of once you start. It's actually quite a boring subject in itself, but he could be an expert, and if he wanted to, he's got a lot of good advice. He just happens to serve evil, in my opinion.
Yeah, and here we are, of course, and it's this whole globalist plan, fear, 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 all for your safety and convenience. We're going to take our first break, and when we return, I'm going to talk to David about his work in the Wentworth Report, specifically how China is trying to spread its wings, and whether President Xi or Dictator Xi, depending on how you look at him, is all in for a war one way or another to try and expand China's interests all around the world. Don't go anywhere for all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you. Visit the What's On events calendar on the TNT website at tntradio.live. Stay in touch on today's News Talk, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real,
it's
dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour is David Archibald. And David's written a number of articles in the Wentworth Report. This one talking about Australia's Defence One, Name Your Enemy. David, you have asked the question straight up about President Xi. My question is he or does he have plans for global dominance? What's going on in that man's head?
Well, there's a traditional Chinese concept called Tianxia, in which the Chinese emperor rules the world. Now, the Japanese had a very similar thing up to World War II, and that's what drove the Japanese. They even had a plan for attacking the continental United States and taking over the world. China's basically inherited that. And Xi had a difficult childhood, but he must have grown up thinking that he'll be the new Yellow Emperor to expand the influence of the Chinese people over the planet.
It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it, to think that you can be part of a population of, you know, over 1.25 billion human beings and somehow believe that you're going to be the one to take them to the next level. That is, it's an ego or something. Have in your work, have you been able to get inside the head? Well, you've certainly done it by providing evidence, and I was hoping that you could provide a bit more of the information, what it is that Xi wants to do. He seems to be determined one way or another. He's got all eyes looking on Taiwan. But explain what's going on there. I mean, can he even manage to feed a country of 1.25 billion beings if they go to war?
Well, he had a plan and expected, you know, Chinese, actually, let's go back a bit. Xi has a plan, but everybody underneath him is now very afraid. No one wants to bring him bad news. So he's not actually told what's going on in the world in total. You and I probably have a better understanding of what's going on in the world. And they have a very low opinion of everybody else on the planet. They think they should be running the planet. And people should send them stuff. It's a traditional tribute system that the Chinese ran on. And everybody has to bow their obsequiousness to China in that worldview. Now, China's got a number of problems, which normally you would stop you from trying to attempt to take over the world, including the fact that they've got 1.3 billion people, and they could feed half of that on a normal diet. China was purely vegetarian just about up till 25 years ago when they started industrializing and importing soybeans from Brazil and the United States. Until then, though, I read an account of Chinese coal miners in northeast China who only ate meat twice a year. It was a pretty poor existence, and China is still overpopulated. The problem with China's demographics was a time bomb left by Chairman Mao. Back in 1959, the president of Beijing University said to Mao, "I think we need a one-child public policy, otherwise we're going to not be able to feed ourselves." And Mao believed in the big battalions. It didn't matter how many people you lost in a battle because you'd be able to replace and overwhelm people. Bear in mind, in those days, people just shot rifles at each other and it was artillery. It was just a mass on mass job. And he was sent up to exile in the country. Mao didn't die until 1976. They didn't institute the one-child policy until 1980, and their population blew out where they couldn't feed themselves anymore. So because he's got a low opinion of the rest of the world, when the Russian invasion of Ukraine came along, that was a big shock to them because they expected to be over in a couple of weeks and everything would go back to normal. But the fact that the West rallied and sanctioned Russia means that China's got a big problem because as soon as the boats stop arriving, then China will start starving. Now, they have about a one-year supply of grain in store, and they've been also storing petroleum products. They've got 1.2 billion barrels in storage. We've got zero. For instance, by comparison, but he also decided that they would clear a lot of countryside in order to grow another 50 million tonne per annum of grain. And the second thing they'll do is they'll import about 50 million tonne a year across the Siberian Railway from Russia. They've got an agreement from the Russians. And they've also decided to clear up every spare scrap of ground to grow more stuff. So they've employed 80,000 rural inspectors to go around chopping down orchards, ripping out bamboo groves. And the point that we're heading to war is they just spent $7 billion Australian equivalent in building a green belt around the western city of Chengdu of about 12 million people. And then after Xi realised he's got a problem with grain supply in a long war, they just ripped all that up and put 40,000 hectares back under the plough to produce about 250,000 tonne per annum of grain. So he's really serious about starting his war and sitting out a long period of sanctions in which all the boats heading towards China are interdicted.
It's incredible, isn't it, that you can have such a massive infrastructure, but of course everything in China based on that population are orders of magnitude higher than anywhere else. If he's not planning for war, I just want to question this. Could he be planning that if Trump returns to office and goes after China for the origins of COVID, that he may be sanctioned that way? Could that be another option as well, why he's becoming so defensive?
No, I think they'll sweep COVID under the rug. It's embarrassing for everybody concerned. When Trump came out initially and said, well, China's the problem for COVID and they should bear the cost of it, actually, the origin of COVID was just down the road in Bethesda, Maryland, at Fauci's office. He was basically the bloke who ran the whole thing. The science came from Ralph Baric at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who'd sent humanized mice to Batwoman at Wuhan Institute of Virology in 2015 and directed how to put the whole thing together. I don't think Trump is very embarrassing what he did over vaccines and everything else. He was snowed by everyone that he relied upon in his administration. I don't think Trump is any different. He's got his own agenda. He's turned 70. He turned 70 last year. Bill Gates attended his birthday. He doesn't want to attack the world in old age. He wants to enjoy part of it, at least being emperor of the planet.
That's an extraordinary a perspective, isn't it, when you think of what's going on? But you can start to put things together when you look at the BRICS alliance as one way. Now, we see it's an alliance. I guess the question to follow that up is does China really have any friends in the world, or is this all a business relationship?
Oh, it doesn't have any friends whatsoever. China's about 15% of the world GDP. The Western countries, US, Europe, and ourselves, are about 65%. You've got South Korea and Japan account for about 10%. And the rest of the world is about 15%. And with the whole BRICS thing, where they've lent money to use Chinese construction companies to build stuff that wasn't needed, just made a lot of enemies as they debt rolls on and bills, and they have to, and these countries have to hand over assets to satisfy that.
What is China's therefore is its, if you, maybe we have to list their most powerful or their best assets. I mean, you described a tribute system, which sounds like we're dealing with gangsters. But is it their population? Is it the size of their global factory, or is it this accumulated wealth? What makes China think that it's so powerful, and for the rest of us see it as so powerful, and not necessarily want to equate that with a threat?
Well, let's look at the real picture of China. Okay, we've got 1.3 billion people, and an area of Australia, only half of its arable land, and a lot of its mountains. They've actually barely, it's a hand-to-mouth existence for a lot of people. The 300 million people that have been taken out of poverty since 2000 live in six coastal provinces. They're the people we'll be fighting in any war. There's another 1 billion people further inland who just get up in the morning and do a bit of scratch around the garden a bit, and that's their total life. As one of the Chinese premiers said about 4 years ago, there are still 600 million people in China who earn less than $141 a month equivalent. And that's about 1/15 of their economy and half their population. And though it makes China very fragile, because if there's a problem with those people, they'll start rioting. And actually, China traditionally has a much bigger police force, federal police force, than they do have an army, just to keep the people under control. In terms of where they've come from, their economy 25 years ago started out with very cheap labor, and they replaced everybody else. But they also had very cheap energy from coal. And their coal production went up from about 500 million tons per annum to now 4.4 billion tons per annum, They import another 500 million tonnes per annum for a total burn of about 5 billion tonnes, which is equivalent to 15 million barrels a day of oil, which is half of world oil consumption. But in doing that, they burnt through half their coal endowment that they started with a couple of century or two ago. And at their current burn rate, they've got 130 billion tonnes of coal left. And each individual Chinese person is burning through that at 3.4 tonnes a year and importing another 300 kilos of coal. Now, they've just about peaked in that, and they'll tip over and decline. The cost of coal out of China will go up. The cost of energy in China is going to go up, rising relentlessly as the decades pass. I don't think they'll be able to build nuclear reactors fast enough to replace the energy production from coal. And the cost of solar power and wind turbines, because that's where we buy them from, will go up much faster than anything else. The big picture view of that from a Chinese professor is that China had this coal endowment. They dug it up, burnt it, and turned it into apartment blocks. So there are now 65 million unoccupied apartments in China. They kept building them because that was the only way that people could save money for themselves. They put it in a bank or it might rot and be stolen, but if they thought that they were buying a pseudo land situation. But those apartment buildings will wear out. They'll just sit there in the sun and they'll need to be torn down in 50 to 70 years. And that's what they're converting their energy into. China's going to come out a lot poorer out of this. It really is smoke and mirrors as an economy and what they can do.
Well, this is something that we're starting to learn a lot more about. I'm wondering, in this false economy, I mean, you can't have 65 million vacant properties just sitting there waiting to rot, depreciate. They don't seem to have a squatter problem like you might have in other parts of the world here. But all roads or pathways seem that they don't have enough energy. They can't build nuclear quick enough. They don't have enough food store. Is there ever going to be a situation where China will actively look to again reduce the population by other means other than a one-child policy?
No, I think Xi made a big mistake. China would be a lot more powerful if they only had 600 million people. They'd be able to feed themselves and what they produce internally. They wouldn't have such a big pull in their energy supply and all that sort of thing. Their population did peak a few years ago. And what has started declining, but Xi came out, first of all, we'll no one-child policy anymore, you can have two, and then it's now three. People haven't responded, they're not reading to order, according to the emperor's command. But I think that everybody's saying, oh, demographic shrinkage is a problem. No, it's what they need to avoid tragedy in the future. Better have that than have whopping great famines. We've lived in ideal times over the last 50 years. There's been no climate coal periods as we've just come out of the little ice age. It's been very benign, and with extra CO2, crop production's up about 20%, and this and that and the other thing. Better to let the population fall away for China.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because he's kind of pushing the other way. He's not actively promoting that, but the Chinese population and the youth of China don't seem to be interested the same way as their parents may have done, certainly not reproducing at any rate. There's a real downturn, youth unemployment, et cetera, in China. Very, very different picture. So it's almost as if he's living 10 years in the past as to where the sentiment of that country is, David. It just seems to be that this so-called emperor, if you will, intent on taking over the world, may be in for a big shock. But it doesn't happen that way in the Chinese Communist Party. There's no opposition.
Well, it's very difficult from this position, somewhere in Australia, to see what's going on. There are signs of the odd little problem internally in the Communist Party. There is a lot of opposition to Xi. People in certainly the older officers in the PLA bought their commissions expecting to make a lot of money out of being corrupt. And there's not much interest in actually fighting a war within the PLA, from what I've heard. There are the odd signs, but I think we're set for war because there doesn't seem to be anything that'll get rid of him.
Well, this is the point, isn't it? And where that war starts, all eyes seem to be on Taiwan and watching along with the Russia-Ukraine conflict and Israel-Palestine. And somehow it seems that NATO allies are trying to do everything they can to get Vladimir Putin to throw the first rock over the fence to start World War III. He's very restrained and holding back at every provocation. Netanyahu in Israel doing everything he can to get everyone in the world offside. It's an extraordinary scenario that we're watching play out in real time. And of course, the big surprise is will Xi move or act? Will he aim for Taiwan? What will be the excuse to go in? Or does he have his sights on another country? And David, you've suggested that he's got his eyes on Vietnam. And I want to talk about that and the work that you've put together and written. We've got some pictures as well. What we'll do is we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll get into David's work in another article from the Wentworth Report called Australia's Defence 2, Just How Nasty Are the Chinese Communists? Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.
JDRF's vision is to create a world without type 1 diabetes. The type 1 diabetes community is at the heart of everything JDRF does. We were founded by the type 1 diabetes community. In the main, we are governed by the type 1 diabetes community, we're energised by the type 1 community, and we're accountable to the type 1 diabetes community. It's on their behalf that we exist, and it's on their behalf that we must succeed. JDRF exists to rid the world of type 1 diabetes. It's easy to say, but it's hard to do. So for us, that means rallying all the resources and all the people and all the organisations required to make that a reality as quickly as possible. The world's best researchers, exciting innovative companies, and the passion of the type 1 diabetes community, then delivered through the health system so lives get better every day, day after day, until the day we find a cure. To everybody in the type 1 diabetes community, no matter your age or stage with the disease, whether you were diagnosed recently or a long time ago, we need you to know that we are here working on your behalf to deliver a world without type 1 diabetes as quickly as we can. Thank you to everybody who's supported JDRF in so many ways. You are making our vision of a world without type 1 diabetes possible.
You ever heard of a polyp? Sounds like a rare species of toad. Actually, it's a lump that grows inside me, your bowel. Look, I'm pretty sure if you had a strange lump growing on your forehead, you might get it looked at, right? But when they're growing inside me, nothing, nada. And the polyps I get can lead to Australia's second deadliest cancer. So, until there's a way to make them grow on your face, it's up to you to get me looked at. Got it?
Discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, David Archibald. And for this segment, we're going to explore one of David's articles, Australia's Defence 2, Just How Nasty Are the Chinese Communists? In a normal country with a normal moral compass, David writes, with ethics, a Coast Guard is for protecting lives at peril on the sea. In China, that is inverted. They built a 12,000-ton Coast Guard vessel to ram and sink the Coast Guard vessels of other countries. They say it can sink up to 5,000 tons without being damaged itself. By comparison, an Arleigh Burke Flight III destroyer of the US Navy is 9,700 tons. David, looking at that on the screen, that is a very impressive Coast Guard ship, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes. Now, the modus operandi of the Chinese is their first layer is the maritime militia, which is fishing boats, where the sailors are given a bit of military training. They carry AK-47s or the equivalent these days. And those are sent in to aggravate whoever they want to aggravate, including the Japanese, the Filipinos, the Vietnamese. And just out from them is the Chinese Coast Guard. So if the militia get, maritime militia get beaten up by the Japanese Coast Guard, these vessels will come over and rescue the Chinese. And then another layer out is the actual PLA Navy. So if the Coast Guard runs into trouble, the PLA Navy will come in and take them on. But there was a concept they had about 10 years ago. They built this vessel to ram other people's Coast Guard vessels, which are obviously quite smaller because you only build them as big as you need them, and sink them on the spot and thus intimidate them. That's their approach to life and people who aren't Chinese.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And somewhere last year, the HMAS Toowoomba was in Japan's exclusive economic zone near the Senkaku Islands and stopped to have its divers clear fishing nets snagged on its propellers. Toowoomba broadcast that it was stopped with divers in the water and warned vessels not to approach it. So a Chinese destroyer sailed towards the Toowoomba and blasted the divers with its sonar. It's an incredible story.
Yes. I think people are getting to understand how the Chinese now think. And there was another incident the year before where an RAAF Orion was P-8 Poseidon, 65 kilometres north of the Australian coast, north of Arnhem Land. And it flew near a Chinese destroyer, which was transiting across the north of Australia. And the Chinese destroyer fired a laser at it in order to blind the pilots. These people have got no idea how to behave in public, so to speak. They're as nasty as can be.
Now, why do you think, therefore, that Anthony Albanese then visits China just a few days after this particular attack on the Toowoomba? Hopefully we can put this picture up just to show you what Albanese's attitude is. When you produce this, this is just shocking. There he is, patting the back of Xi 3 days after he's attacking our own people here. What is going on?
I don't know. Well, Albanese must be a bit screwed up. I think he's actually... That photo is vomit-inducing to my mind. Australian military personnel, defence personnel, are harmed. The Chinese go out of their way to harm them, and he wants to get handsy with Xi. It was actually at an APEC meeting in San Francisco 3 days after the incident. I think Albanese is either incompetent or foolish or is way out of his depth. Personal relationships aren't going to cut it at this point at all. Never did with the Chinese.
Yeah, this is what's just so disturbing, isn't it? Because there has been a legacy in Australian politics since the days of Paul Keating being very extremely, you know, sort of pro-China and pro-Asia. And of course, there's nothing wrong with being able to change relations. But when things change, when circumstances change, Keating is still apologising for China at every turn. Albanese stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, he's introducing and following on with AUKUS, which is to defend against China. And on the other hand, when China attacks Australia, he's patting his opponent on the back. I mean, it's totally illogical. It makes no sense to even see what's going on here. But you can't play both sides of the fence and be friends to all people, can you?
No, but let's go back to Keating. And there was a few other politicians who also, as soon as they retired, the Chinese put them on retainers. I think Keating has been on about $2 million a year, and every time he's quoted, it should be stated how much he's getting, or when did the Chinese stop paying him directly, or if they are still paying him. One of the Liberal ministers, who was known as a right-winger, was on $800,000 a year in retirement from the Chinese. They just have no moral authority.
And it's always about business interests and obviously to power. Now, we talked about before the break the idea that China, as many people are focusing on, the one China policy going into Taiwan. But you've suggested and you're providing evidence here that they might have their eyes on Vietnam. Can you explain your reasoning and why that would be?
Well, there's an old saying, don't rely on what people say, look at what they do. And if you look at satellite imagery of the Chinese coast, they haven't laid much concrete for an invasion of Taiwan. There's a whole lot of little islands near the Chinese coastline. And if you wanted to plan an invasion of Taiwan, you'd have little ports, you'd have helicopter pads, you'd have do everything to make the job of invading Taiwan a lot easier. It's much easier to have a helicopter spend another 20 minutes circling over Taiwan or close to it and be able to land at an island, get refueled. Now, they've built an expeditionary helicopter base in the Nanji Islands, just north of that Taiwan Strait. But that's for an attack on the Senkakus. Now, if you look at what the concrete that they've laid for an invasion of Vietnam, it's actually quite considerable. One of the problems they had in 1979 when they last invaded was that the logistics were quite poor up to the Vietnamese border, and they couldn't get supplies to their troops on the front line. So now, I didn't include in this, but if you look at the satellite photography, there's a whopping great four-lane highway heading straight to the Vietnamese border. And even part of it looks like they plan to extend it over the border at some stage, the way it ends up. But in that, one of those images I have is of a Chinese military base only 10 kilometers north of the border. It's a whole pile of sheds. There's no other reason. There's no commercial activity. None of this satellite imagery shows any trucks or people around it. But that's been built, in my opinion, so that they can bring up armored units, tanks and artillery and the like, at night, hide them in the sheds, and be ready to attack one morning. And they've also built artillery pads along the border where a concrete road comes up to a mountain ridge and there's widens out to a pad, and that's to enable them fire support for the invasion. So, okay, there's another big thing why they would choose Vietnam first. Their whole claim to the South China Sea is based on it being Chinese territory from ancient times, and their spirits wouldn't, you know, ancient ancestors' spirits wouldn't allow them to give it up. But the Vietnamese have got 47 bases in the South China Sea, in the Spratlys, and they make a mockery of the Chinese claim. So my interpretation is that there'll be an armored assault across the Vietnamese border, and the Chinese will undertake not to withdraw until Vietnam's given up those bases in the Spratly Islands. Now, the funny thing about the whole Vietnam-China relationship is they're both communist dictatorships who are quite repressive. The Vietnamese traditionally have been, communists have been traditionally just as repressive as the Chinese have been. But when Chinese economy started pulling away from 2000, and China went from being only 10 times bigger than Vietnam to 15 to 20 times bigger, the Vietnamese thought, well, we'll get overwhelmed if we have another war and invasion from China. So Vietnam only opened up to the world, simply enabled to have a bigger economy in order to be able to fight off the Chinese. So with the extra money they've made, and they've been growing at 7% per annum recently, as manufacturers have left China and gone to Vietnam to start operation. Samsung's a big one that's done that. It's given them more money to play with. And so they've gone to their bases in the South China Sea and started expanding them, as per the Chinese did, by using kind of suction dredges to make whopping great artificial islands and expand their bases. And which means there'll be a bigger fight for the Chinese, because it's much harder to kill a base that's spread out over a large area versus concentrating artillery on just a small island that the Vietnamese started with. And Xi made a statement only last month that the China should prepare for maritime disputes in territorial integrity and all that. And that opaque language can be decoded to saying, we'll have a maritime battle against Vietnam over the Spratlys. Now, there's another attraction in that Vietnam, by its constitution, isn't allowed to have defense treaties with other parties. So recently, the Japanese have been talking to the Philippines about basing Japanese troops in the Philippines, so to be a tripwire, so that Japan's involved in any dispute from day one, any war that China starts, and in case the US doesn't come to the party.
It's an interesting set of circumstances, isn't it, when you think that that China would keep its eyes on Vietnam, knowing that it doesn't have any defence treaties and it's nearby, and therefore they've certainly got their eyes on it. But what advantage has it got for China? Is it simply to occupy and to take over the land and expand the Chinese empire? Is that all that the method is? Because if they do that, there can't be anyone in Asia, or certainly anyone around the world, that's going to have any empathy at all for China.
No, they're not worried about the empathy thing at all. fact, most politics are internal, but they simply want to be able to stomp on the Vietnamese booth till the face till the end of time. It's like Orwell's said, if you want a picture of the future, it's a human face with a boot being stomped on it. Now, if China is able to pull off this control of the whole of the Spratlys and stop other countries from crossing the South China Sea, a Chinese ship from Haiphong Harbour near Hanoi would have to travel another 3,000 kilometres to go to Japan and have to go right round the bottom of the Spratlys and up the east of the Philippines to get to Japan. And China wants to institute that so that they know, everybody else knows their place in the pecking order, and Vietnam will fight, in my opinion. I mean, Vietnamese friends of mine have told me that they'll fight. I've been told that the Vietnamese on those islands in the South China Sea have been told it will be a fight to the death.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And everyone knows that the Vietnamese could certainly hold off the United States, and being able to take on China is just part of what they want to do, because they're not giving up at all. Now, there's another topic, and I don't know if we could call it an open secret or a closed secret, and you've written about it in this article, and you're referring to organ harvesting. Is it an open secret around the world that you can just buy human organs, or is this some secret thing that we're not meant to know about, David?
No, it's not secret. It's been known 10 to 15 years. It all started when they had political prisoners and older party members who needed new organs. Well, they would say, well, let's pop off a political prisoner and get your organs. And then they decided to make money out of it. And then a new technology came along called extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which means that they could, usually when you take your heart out, the rest of the body dies. But in this new proposal, they keep processing people's blood to keep it oxygenated, and then they can take four organs at once. Certainly with when the Falun Gong started being persecuted, then the kidney transplant rates doubled in China because there were far more organs available. And they've been advertising it, and people go to China for those transplants, and you only have to wait a couple of weeks as you're matched up against somebody who's already in the prison system.
It's beyond, you can't even call it shocking. It's just at a level that the average human being could not contemplate. Yeah, we may have heard about it in a horror film or read about it in an article as a once-off, but what you're saying is that this is a complete industrialized, it's an industry now of organ trading. And in China, a so-called communist country where you're all meant to share in the spoils and everyone's equal, nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm. Yes, indeed. I don't have any further comments on it, no. That's where it is, and this is the morality of the people we're dealing with. Mm. And anybody buying anything Chinese has got the blood of those innocents on their hands, and that blood stains their soul. So just be aware of what you're doing when you buy anything from China. You're promoting, supporting human killing off live people to sell their organs.
Now, do you think that there's any hope for the Chinese people to be able to separate themselves from this regime, or is this a revolution too big for our lifetimes?
No, it could very well be. There have been 28 changes in regime in China over thousands of years, and always a new regime comes along and replaces them. And the way China's going, they could very well have a mass famine, which results in the removal of the Chinese Communist Party. Bear in mind that Wang Yuling, who's been advisor on philosophical matters to the last three Chinese presidents and is a member of the standing committee of the Chinese Communist Party Politburo, has said that as the existence of one democracy anywhere on the planet is a threat to the Chinese Communist Party, because that's an alternative way of organizing human existence. And then look at a place like Singapore, which is a majority Chinese population, happily running as a democracy, and now the democracies on the planet, Taiwan itself, is Chinese people, some of them, who are happily running a democracy and everybody's happy. And that's a threat to the Chinese Communist Party to have an alternative way of running society.
And you look at what's going on around the world with the turmoil that's happening almost everywhere you look. It doesn't seem to be much that everyone's looking forward to and thinking that life in the future is going to be better tomorrow than it is today. And the only way that it happens, or that does happen, is that this great big collapse of the Roman Empire, the Chinese Empire, all around the world, we're waiting to see what's going to happen as we seem to be manipulated to within an inch of our last breath. David, we've reached, unfortunately, the end of our time today. I want to say thank you for coming on the show again. I love reading your work at thewentworthreport.com for those that want to check it out. Really appreciate the work that you're doing. Don't stop. I know that you are an absolute machine, being able to produce incredible work across so many great areas, and I thank you for that. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a brand new guest for this show, Nathan Livingston of the Milk Bar TV, will be on the other side. We're going to have a chat about his great work since it was forced upon him, and he's going from strength to strength. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends with Jason Olborne here on TNT.